There was once a land where the weather was very, very strange. There were awful heat waves in some parts, and in others, terrible storms and floods.
Greenhouse gas.
Heating the world.
Friends, did a month of rainfall late last night, rivers flood in the fall, 214 all-time heat records in the U.S. September 24th, 30 degrees in Toronto, feeling like 37 with the humidity, the heat of the human body. Worried about your kids? You might have post-climatic stress disorder. Yes, PTSD is a serious condition, but don't worry, professional help is on the way.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Climate Psychology 101, kids, with psychologist Robert Gifford and Joseph Reeser, plus new film on the granddaddy of the double bind, Gregory Bateson.
Dr. Joseph Reeser is adjunct associate professor in the School of Psychology at Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. He has written extensively on environmental psychology. From Australia, Joseph Reeser, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Hi there. Well, Dr. Reeser, we have enough science to know climate change is happening. We have the numbers, the satellite data, historic records, endless measurements. And yet, climate legislation failed to appear in North America and lots of other places in the world. It's a free-for-all to dump more greenhouse gases. This seems to be a failure of the human mind to grasp our situation. Can psychology help?
Well, certainly they can help. I mean, it's our business, I guess, to look at how people make sense out of the world in which they live and how that influences their behavior. And I think one of the things that's been missed a little bit with respect to psychology and climate change, if you want, is that how people are making sense out of this event really matters. It really matters in terms of the actions that they take. It really matters in terms of the impact that this threat has on their lives and circumstances. And if we really want to be effective in changing people's behavior, then we need to better understand public understandings of this phenomenon.
Could you tell us about the new report on the climate from the American Psychological Association?
The American Psychological Association was very keen to kind of communicate what psychology has to offer, you know, in a collaborative way to climate change science, because we keep hearing discussions of climate change mitigation and adaptation, and there seems to be very little reference to human experience, to how this is impacting on individuals, to taking action at an individual level. You know, the conversation has been very much about structural considerations. And actually, we do have a lot of very good data about human response to situations like this. And I guess we are keen to be able to communicate this to other scientists, and also for them to understand that, for example, climate change adaptation is not just about system and structural adaptation. It's very much about human experience and human adaptation, and that actually we've been talking about psychological adaptation for the last 100 years, and yet it doesn't seem to be on the radar of climate change scientists.
Listeners, I'm going to put a link to that American Psychological Association report in the Radio EcoShock blog. You just go to ecoshock.info and you'll find it. You just finished some research on the attitudes of Australians toward climate change. What did you find?
Well, what we found, we were working collaboratively with Cardiff University in the UK, because they've been looking at public attitudes and responses to climate change and energy futures there for a number of years, and energy futures in the UK and Europe generally are tied up with nuclear power plants, and as to whether that might be a kind of a more palatable, I guess, to the voting electorate now that carbon emissions seem to be a quite serious problem. But in Australia, there hadn't ever been any kind of in-depth national research with respect to, well, how does the public understand the phenomenon of climate change? And basically what we found, I mean, we're still working through our data, but certainly we found very high levels of concern, both in Australia and the UK, almost identical levels of concern, which is very discrepant from a lot of media coverage of this notion that there's kind of what we would call a risk attenuation, that climate change seems to be, you know, 17th down the list on people's list of concerns. Well, that's not what our findings say at all. Our findings suggest that climate change is very salient. People are very concerned. They understand climate change in a different way. There's a myth out there that public understandings of climate change is about understanding climate change science. Well, I don't think that's the case at all. I think people understand climate change in very human, you know, cultural terms, and that may not equate very closely at all with climate change science. And so we can't really measure public understandings of climate change by seeing how well they understand the science. Public understandings are a different kind of thing. But there's no doubt that people are not only very concerned about it, that it's impacting on people's lives and experience. We included measures of psychological distress with respect to what seems to be happening around them, and those measures indicated considerable psychological distress in Australia. We also looked closely at how people understood kind of natural disaster phenomena as compared with global climate change. And in Australia, the language of climate change is very much the language of natural disasters. Climate change, if you want, has become the idiom of distress for many problems that people see in the world and in the Australian context. So when people are talking about, you know, floods or drought or cyclones or bushfires, the rhetoric, the talk is very much about climate change, that things are changing. These are the manifestations of it. So in Australia, perhaps in a somewhat different way than North America, climate change is here now in people's face. And it's a real concern and issue in rural and remote mental health, for example, in Australia. And again, in a way that it is not, I think, in North America.
Yes, people have had to leave their farms because of the drought. You had those tremendous firestorms, which were deadly as well, and floods at the same time. So I can see how people might be coming around, as they are in Russia after the events with the heat storm in Moscow and the fires outside of it. You know, I first heard you on an excellent ABC National radio program called All in the Mind. And in that program, you said that there were no psychologists and very few social scientists involved in writing that big climate report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Why not, and why should they have been there?
Well, I think in a way the origins of the international panel and kind of the sort of scientific, the climate change science focus on this phenomena, you know, I guess it was spearheaded by natural scientists and physical geographers and climatologists. And a large interdisciplinary group of people that work on these kind of global patterns, global issues. Indeed, internationally, there's been funding for global environmental change for the last 30 years, substantial funding. That now is more spoken of in terms of climate change, but that focus and emphasis has been there for a very long time. But I think in a way that there's always been a kind of marginalization of psychology and social science with respect to environmental problems generally. And that's particularly unfortunate because sociologists and anthropologists and psychologists and political scientists, we've been working on environmental issues since the late 60s. You know, and there's a wealth of data about understanding why people behave in particular ways that have adverse environmental impacts, and also how adverse environmental impacts really influence people's concerns and anxieties and quality of life. And so I think that this is just a good example of that. But what our mission was, I guess, is to communicate to not only climate change scientists and policymakers, but we're really talking about profoundly important changes in the human environment as well as the biophysical environment here, and certainly very powerful impacts on the human environment as well as the physical environment, and that we need to better understand both of these, particularly if the challenges that are facing us are how to turn people's behavior around and also how to assist people and communities in coping with what may be a very apocalyptic event, in that climate change for many social and physical scientists is a global natural disaster, a global emergency, but it may be with us for the next few thousand years. And we really need to focus on the human side of this as well as the biophysical side of this.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Joseph Reeser from the School of Psychology at Griffith University in Australia. You've raised a point that I've been thinking about for some time, that millions of good people are not only blocked from action by the overwhelming fear of more chaos, let us say, in the natural world, but they are suffering psychologically. Do you see a new therapeutic field developing to help people through, say, climate anxiety?
I see a sort of an expansion of what is there. I mean, I do a lot of work in natural disasters. Disaster mental health is kind of a very big area that's been going for a very long time. You know, like what some of my work in Australia, for example, is to help people to psychologically prepare for cyclones or hurricanes in North American terms, and bushfires and other disasters as well. And then the reality is that the psychological reality is that it is hard for people to think about these events because they're quite frightening often. They often are not as physically prepared as they should be for these events, but more importantly, they're not psychologically prepared. Often people, particularly people who have no experience, for example, being in a hurricane, they have no idea how they're going to be feeling and responding to the events that are going to encircle them in that situation. And so what we advocate is assisting people to be better psychologically prepared for disasters generally, and then they're usually better situationally prepared for that. But basically, there's a large literature there that's very helpful, really, in terms of, well, how are people kind of getting their heads around the situation of global environmental change and what consequences are going to be for the environment and for people. And to do that, we need to look more closely at how they're making sense out of this event. And what we tend to forget is that for most of the people in the developed and urban world, their encounter with global climate change is through the media. You know, it's indirect, it's virtual, it's very psychologically unreal in many ways. You know, how do we discriminate between the coverage of what might be happening at the South Pole or, you know, in Africa or Southeast Asia from an environmental documentary? It's very hard to, you know, discriminate between fiction and fact. And of course, the whole phenomena of climate change is very complex. There seems to be a lot of discrepant information that comes from the media. The media is given equal time to scientists and climate change skeptics, even though scientists, you know, are 99% very worried about this problem. But the public could be excused for thinking that there's some real controversy out there because of the way things are covered. And so we have to understand that there's a certain level of psychological unreality about all of this for people in terms of understanding it, in terms of making it personal and asking how it's going to affect their own lives and their own community, you know, their own local environment. I think we totally forget about that. We think that everybody's directly in touch with this global climate change phenomena. Well, that just doesn't make sense.
It's true, but I think the media coverage does have an impact. Many of the people that I talk to, at least those who become more aware of climate change, they go through a period of deep fear for their children and their grandchildren about what's coming up. And I'm just to take the devil's advocate here, maybe we shouldn't try and lull people or heal people, because this personal pressure may be needed to drive a change in lifestyle and get them to demand real change from politicians. Maybe can people be frightened into making the right choices? Will they ever change without some painful stimulus forcing them to?
Oh, look, you're absolutely right in many ways, because this has been a real challenge in health psychology, for example, or the health profession generally. You need to tailor your risk communications, whether it be, alcohol or smoking or cancer, carcinogens. You need to tailor your information so that people are very concerned about a very real problem, but not so overwhelmed by anxiety that they don't take the corrective action that's necessary. So we're always looking at how to get the fear appeal right. And I think with respect to climate change that there is a problem in terms of how the media has been dealing with it. I mean, they have quite rightly said this is a profound issue, and that it's a global peril that we have to take very seriously, and we have to change our lives accordingly. But I think that you also have to make it personal to people in a particular way, so that it's personally meaningful. What has happened in the media coverage is that it's very global. For example, if you look at media coverage, you know, it's polar bears marooned on ice floes, or things that are happening at the poles, or in the Sahel in Africa, in other places. And people look out their kitchen window and everything looks pretty well okay, and so they're getting these images that are very psychologically distant. They're distant in space, they're distant in time in terms of when this could happen. They acknowledge that, yes, there seem to be real problems out there, but they're not of immediate personal consequence, and they're not of particular consequence perhaps to their own local environment. And part of that is because the images are all global. And also then people kind of unconsciously say to themselves, well, these problems seem to be caused by and a consequence for people elsewhere. They should shoulder the responsibility for that. If something was happening in my own local community, I'd be very concerned about that. I'd be out there doing something about it. But everything sort of looks okay here. And also, if it's truly a global problem, what could I do about it anyway? And so there's this offloading of responsibility to that global community. It's kind of their problem. And I think there is a way to make the global local. There is a way to get people to think globally, act locally, and respond personally. And that's a way of bringing kind of the ecosphere home, in a way, to people. And so even in health communications, we have to take the problem and the anxiety that might be raised, and at the same time, give people some practical things that they can do about that. And not just about the environmental problem, but they need some practical strategies for how to cope with how they're feeling about this. You know, some psychological advice to kind of how to handle this and still go on and, you know, engage in some behavior that's going to be meaningful in terms of carbon reduction and in terms of addressing the problem. People want to do the right thing. They want to feel that they're responsible, that they're kind of aware of and of the problem and really doing something about it. But they need some assistance sometimes, both in good information about what they can actually do about the problem in terms of their own life circumstances. But they also need some good psychological information about how they might be feeling in the face of what looks like a pretty apocalyptic scenario here. And that's missing at the moment.
So if we were to get out of our car and take the bike one time a week to work, that may not save the planet or the atmosphere, but it has a deep feeling for ourselves and makes us feel better about ourselves, and maybe that's important too.
Yes, I think there's been a problem in the way it's been framed. For example, there's so much discussion about environmentally significant behavior, which really is about adaptation and reduction of carbon emissions, as though that's the only thing that matters. Well, what really matters to people is that what they're doing is psychologically meaningful. So I and other psychologists have been saying that we need to look at psychologically significant behavior as well as environmentally significant behavior. In fact, they go hand in hand. Because if what you're doing is not psychologically significant, then you're not going to be doing what is environmentally significant. And the counter to that, some people would say, oh, you're just engaging in some kind of self-therapy here. It's really not doing anything relating to the problem. But that's to completely miss the point that, you know, what we're doing has to be psychologically meaningful for us to keep doing it, for us to be kind of working on that larger mitigation problem as well. And really the whole world now is focusing on adaptation because so much is now set in concrete. You know, so the next 100 years is going to play out pretty much the way it's shaping up, no matter what is done. But the next 1,000 years really matters. So I'm not saying that people shouldn't be focusing on environmentally significant behavior. But there's this immediate need to really look at how people are dealing with this, how they're coping. And the thing is that taking action in one's local environment has multiple benefits. Not only do you feel empowered, you know, you're not engaged in the denial and learned helplessness you might be feeling anyway. You can feel that you're doing the right thing. You can feel that you're being part of the solution, not just part of the problem. You can kind of take meaningful steps to change your life circumstances and your personal footprint on the planet. But that isn't just the simple kind of thinking, globally, acting locally. It really requires us responding personally, so that when you engage in behaviors that might otherwise be absent-minded, for example, in terms of not buying bottled water or riding your bike instead of taking your car, you need to be mindful that actually this really matters, you know, that I have this relationship with my local natural environment. I can see the effects that my own actions take in my local environment, but because I'm engaged in this, I sort of immediately understand that there are larger planetary systems at play here. There are interdependencies. You know, that this is spaceship Earth. You know, I live in a compartment of it, and that what I do really does matter, not only to me and my community and my local environment, but we're all part of this whole. And that's where this responding personally is really the missing link in thinking globally, acting locally. And I guess what we've been trying to do is take this simple notion, this distilled wisdom of thinking globally, acting locally, and saying, look, you know, there's some very important psychological considerations here. And in a larger way, these psychological considerations are missing in the climate change science debate, and they have to be there. You know, we're not going to change behavior by excluding psychology, sociology, anthropology. These are critical disciplines.
I appreciate what you're saying. We're going to put the personal back in, and we're going to put the human back in. We have been talking with Dr. Joseph Reeser, an expert in climate psychology from Griffith University in Queensland, Australia. Dr. Reeser, thank you so much for your insight.
You're most welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, asking, why don't we do more to prevent climate change? Why? For that, we need to enter the puzzle of the human mind. Our guide is a world-recognized expert in the psychology of climate change. Dr. Robert Gifford is a professor of psychology and environmental studies at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada. He's taught there since 1979. He's a fellow of both the Canadian and American Psychological Associations. He helped found the Pacific Institute for Climate Change Solutions. And he's written so many science publications and many book chapters. He's the editor of the Journal of Environmental Psychology. Let's talk with him now. Robert Gifford, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here, too, because we have some problems we do have to sort out. You know, most of our Radio EcoShock interviews are with scientists studying physical things like ancient rocks, melting ice, or rising temperatures. Why is psychology so often left out of the climate change debate?
I think there's a number of reasons, but maybe I'm thinking in particular of a quote by Robert Heinlein, if you want to have a half-science connection here, who said back in 1953, man, as he said at that point, is not a rational animal. He's a rationalizing animal. And so a lot of the problems have to do with people not being rational about environmental issues.
In order to express some of your rather complex ideas about climate psychology, you've developed the model of dragons. Can you explain that general concept for us?
Yes. Dragons is a metaphor that I use for what could be stated as the reasons why we don't do things that even we think we should do, but as opposed to people who don't even think we need to do anything about the climate or global warming.
But these aren't really mythological things. These are ideas or behaviors that you can find in people and to some degree measure?
Right. Dragon is just something that came to me in the middle of the night one day, and I agree that dragons are metaphorical or mythical, I suppose. But these barriers, if we want to use more plain English, we could also call them barriers or obstacles to action.
We won't have time to explore all the 13 dragons that you found just so far. Let's talk the top most prevalent ones that you did find from a survey of Canadians, and that was done in Ontario, and 41% of those surveyed had this one, which you called perceived behavioral control. What does that mean, and how do we experience it?
Well, Alex, I have to tell you that since I did that, the dragons are kind of in their den doing what dragons do, and they've been multiplying. There are now 29 of them. So just so that your listeners know, there's a lot more than 13 now. But to answer your question, perceived behavioral control, or PBC, is the sense that I don't have the power or efficacy to change the situation. So it wouldn't help if I did something because I don't have the power to make a difference by myself. Well, similar to the voting problem, my one vote won't change anything, so I'm not going to vote. But if we translate that to what we're talking about, if I ride my bike to work or to school, it's such a small drop in the bucket and such a big cost to me, getting wet in the rain or what, getting potential for risk of injury at whatever cost of a new bike, that I just don't think I'll do it because it's not going to make enough of a difference.
And then the second most high-rated excuse for inaction was social norms and equity. What do you mean by that?
We're all, whether we want to admit it or not, heavily influenced by the significant others around us, the people that we admire that are close to us. Whether it's a boss or a spouse or a friend or a family member or somebody we admire. And those people have a lot of influence on our choices. So if we happen to be in a group of significant others who are doing what we could call the wrong thing, then there's going to be a lot of influence on us to follow that norm. But it can obviously work the other way if I'm part of a group of people who are trying to do everything they can to reduce their carbon footprint, for example, then I'm probably going to be influenced that way as well. So we're more influenced than maybe we want to believe by what other people do, that other people that we admire and like do.
Sure, we see successful people and they're driving very good cars and they're flying all over the world and they're leading a high carbon lifestyle and we would like to be like them. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Oh, of course, yeah. And some very interesting studies showing the power of norms. Might take longer than we have here, but to try to summarize this, because it's a sort of a modern classic, when people in Southern California were told on their electricity bill that they were using more energy or less energy than the average resident of their neighborhood, they tended to change their actual electricity use just by looking at their electricity bill.
The category you labeled reactants didn't really surprise me. I found, especially in young males, a group of people who think they can express their individuality through rebellion. We see all kinds of YouTube videos that speak to me that way. They think it's cool to go against common perception and they deny that climate change exists or that humans have anything to do with it. Now, do I have that right? Would that be reactants or do you mean something different from that?
Well, it's a little bit different from that, Alex, although what you talked about is the result of the original impulse. A reactance is the sense that somebody is taking away our freedom. So we lash out or act out in the ways that you mentioned, but the source of that is I don't want anybody to tell me what to do, especially if it's something I don't want to do. It's a 2-year-old mentality, if you will, that occurs sometimes even people older than 2 years old.
It's a huge social phenomenon, maybe the Tea Party movement.
Oh, boy, I think there's a strong connection to the Tea Party movement. Yeah, I mean, that one of the main themes, of course, of the Tea Party movement is smaller government, unless it means you're cutting off subsidies to my coal mine. But generally, it's, you know, I don't want big government because I don't want government to tell me what to do. So it's that Tea Party is heavily influenced by reactants.
Of course, I don't want to put that down. I mean, I don't want government to tell me what to do about something. So there is a valid feeling, perhaps, in this.
Well, it's not a matter of valid or not. It's reality. It's human nature and reality. So you can put a positive valence on it or a negative valence. It's all of these dragons are real, and then it's a matter of dealing with them after that.
Well, the final one I'd like to bring out is outright denial. What is behind this and how does it operate?
I've learned from talking to quite a few people about this that, you know, to be fair, there's a kind of a range of skepticism and denial. As one denial intellectual PhD denier said to me, you know, why are you complaining when people raise issues about climate change, but you wouldn't criticize me if I raised issues about some other scientific theories? That is, there is a legitimate role for balanced questioning, let's say, of any scientific enterprise. And that's on the end of denial and skepticism that I would say is maybe not such a bad thing. And some things have, in the IPCC report, et cetera, have been uncovered. And, you know, the IPCC group and report isn't perfect. And most of the authors of it would agree that it's not perfect. So there is a role for some skepticism. But then when you go to the other end of kind of blind anti-intellectualism and every scientist is just trying to get a grant to get rich, et cetera, and kind of reasons that don't make any sense on an objective basis, I'm not sure what the motive is there, except I tend to put it down to a broad umbrella called ideology. So if I hold a very broad general right-wing ideology that would cover a lot of social issues, probably that's going under that umbrella is going to be an anti-environmentalism. In a few cases, if you hold a fundamentalist religious view, then one of the consequences is going to be that God won't let anything bad happen to his people or something like that. So there's a whole spectrum in the skepticism to denial range, and some are maybe even a good idea, and some are definitely not a good idea.
But again, you discovered that the number of people in denial wasn't all that high, and yet to listen to the media or, again, YouTube postings, you would think they are the majority. How does that happen?
Well, it's a good question. I don't have a really good answer to that. But it's certainly true that complaining, as generally stereotyped as being Fox News and a couple of the talking heads on Fox News, just seems to sell better than kind of reasoned intellectual, academic, scientific talk. There's been a couple of attempts to start, if you want to call it that, pro-global warming radio stations. And even the people who are convinced of global warming are less interested than the kind of histrionics that come from the Fox News people. So I don't know why, except to kind of restate what you just said. For some reason, the deniers are more vocal than the believers.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith here with Dr. Robert Gifford from the University of Victoria. We are talking about the so-called dragons' behaviors and ideas that seem to prevent action on climate change. Let's try now, Dr. Gifford, to move beyond psychological barriers towards solutions. I want a simple, single answer for all this, and you're not going to give it to me. Why not?
Well, because there's at least five ways to slay the dragons. I can try to list them pretty quickly. One is to understand how behavior works, which behaviors are more impactful, which ones are not, and then to target particular behaviors. Another one is that we need to develop more interventions and policies and to evaluate how effective they are. Another one, I'm a psychologist, but I'm the first person who had said we need interdisciplinary approaches to this, to work with technology people, with even humanities and philosophers and other social scientists to solve problems. A very important one is, because climate change is often seen as far away and in the future and far away geographically, to show people how it's really affecting where they live now in their own neighborhood. And the fifth way is for everybody simply to make the resolution to take at least one small step toward being active in the public sphere as opposed to only in the private sphere of, say, just recycling or riding their bike, but to be a little more public about their concerns.
And you found in one of your studies that people tended to be more optimistic about what is happening or going to happen right around them and think that the big problems will all happen far away. Did I get that right?
That's right. I mean, we have a tendency to say it here and now everything is okay, because if it wasn't, it would be more threatening to ourselves, to our ego, if you want to use that term. So it's more psychologically comforting to say everything is okay here. The problems are over there somewhere. But really, the funny thing is that people over there think that the problems are okay there, and they're bigger problems where I live. And so we all have to get beyond this kind of, probably of too strong a word would be infantile thinking, but self-ego protecting thinking that the problems are only somewhere else.
Dr. Gifford, I found this statement in a slide from one of your talks, quote, younger consumers think more about energy and water as a climate change problem, and older consumers think about food as a climate change problem, end quote. And I suppose that dates me because I think food will be the key destabilizing problem coming out of climate change in this century at least. But if I want to appeal to younger people, should I be covering these other issues more?
Well, absolutely. I mean, my kind of concluding thought on the whole matter is that the messages that we send out have to be suited to the different kinds, groups, categories, demographics of people out there, because they do have different concerns. Everybody has got part of the elephant right, I guess, or part of the elephant in terms of their concern, and it's only appropriate to talk to what's important to different people.
There will always be some suspicion, if I may say, among many people about being manipulated by psychology. So far, we feel a bit abused by psychologists advising advertising agencies or major corporate polluters. So when it comes to climate change, how can psychologists really help the general public, average people like ourselves?
First, it's a kind of myth that only some people are manipulating other people. I think anybody who's honest anywhere in the world will realize when they think about it that we all try to influence each other. We try to influence our children, our spouses, our friends. They're trying to influence us. Influence is just pervasive and natural. The question is, what are the best things to be influenced about? And I don't have any problem saying I'm trying to influence people to reduce their carbon footprint because it's a good thing. I don't want to use any deception, but I'm happy to put out the facts, to educate people about what the dragons are, because if you don't know what the dragons are, it's hard to get beyond the dragons, and to help to translate the sometimes very complex science into facts that people can relate to in their own lives. I'm trying to influence people, but I think it's for honestly good reasons.
Oh, there are some good psychologists out there, yes. We're running out of time, and we haven't tackled one of the most difficult problems from my perspective, how to cope with the personal distress of such big changes to our climate, things like floods and fires or disappearing species and landscapes. Are there people working on this as a public health issue?
Yes, there are some psychologists. You know, as you and your listeners might know, not every psychologist is a clinical Freudian type psychology. Some people just study normal behavior, people of everyday people, and I'm one of them. But there are some clinical psychologists who are specializing in helping people who are very acutely feeling the global warming or climate change issues, and they try to deal with that like they would with any other psychological problem.
The trouble is, though, I mean, this is a real fear, if you will. I mean, we have good reasons to be very concerned about our children's futures.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a kind of parallel here to the fears, and again, it was real fears of nuclear war that were bigger in the 50s and 60s, and people then at that time had similar proportion of people were more concerned than most people or had serious problems. And so clinical psychologists simply have to combine their talents to perhaps encourage people to translate their anxiety into some kind of action, or to ameliorate their anxiety into some sort of, simply to use some sort of anxiety reducing techniques if the anxiety is such that it's really interfering with their daily life.
Is there anything you'd like to add, a parting message for our listeners?
The parting message I would have is, if you are concerned, try to get beyond the private sphere of doing things in your own life and try to find yourself at some table, because if you're not at the table, then you won't be part of the policy. And it could be in the organization you're part of, school or work. It could be in your neighborhood. It could be at the municipal or city level. It could be at a regional level or a state or provincial level, federal level, or even a global level. And I found that some people are more comfortable at one or other of these levels, and they're more afraid or concerned, or they balk at another level. But I think everybody can find one level that they could step out of their private life to take some action at. And so I encourage people to find the level that suits them.
You have been listening to Dr. Robert Gifford, Professor of Psychology and Environmental Studies at the University of Victoria in Canada. Dr. Gifford is a world-recognized expert in the psychology of climate change. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
EcoShock.org.
And Gregory said, "The major problems in the world are the result of the difference between how nature works and the way people think."
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I am joined by Nora Bateson, filmmaker and daughter of the famous social scientist Gregory Bateson. Nora's new movie is An Ecology of Mind, an intellectual biography of Gregory. Nora, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Gregory Bateson was an innovator and founder in many fields. I learned of his ecological theories in the 1970s, partly due to Stuart Brand, publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog. Bateson, quotes, inspired me, but I have to tell you, they also mystified me at the same time. For those who don't know, can you give us a quick snapshot of our subject? Where did Gregory Bateson come from, and what was his official scientific training?
I'm glad to hear you say that you were mystified, because I think if you're mystified, that's a good sign. Gregory's training came originally from his own household. His father, William Bateson, was a scientist and a geneticist, in fact, and one of Britain's foremost biologists of his time. In fact, he coined the term genetics. So William Bateson, Gregory's father, really instilled in his kids a pursuit for the interaction between things. I mean, of course, that at its core is how genetics has been studied. So that he integrated, William Bateson, the works of William Blake and his love for art with his love for nature and his fascination with pattern. And that would go on to be very important to Gregory's work. He studied at Cambridge and got a degree in zoology. And at that point, he went to Galapagos, I think, in 1924, and decided that he didn't really want to take samples, and he wasn't sure how to fit the way that zoology was functioning at that time in with the pursuit of his own interests. So he became an anthropologist and was on his way to New Guinea fairly soon after that and met with Margaret Mead. At that time, there wasn't any particular degree you could get in anthropology. It was a brand new field. 1936, I think or 33, they went over and met in New Guinea. They together started to formulate what became a kind of a lens that brought together William Bateson's approach of looking for pattern and his love of the arts with Margaret's study in behavior. And they brought it together to form what would be a lens that Gregory then used throughout his work in several different disciplines, ranging from psychology to semiotics to anthropology. He was at the sort of beginning of the cybernetics, I don't want to say movement, the beginning of the formation of what became cybernetics. And he focused with that lens on all manner of life in all its different forms, from a biological level to a psychological level to anthropological, culture, math, in all these different directions, and was looking for how things are related, interrelated, interdependent.
He's a tricky man to define, partly because he didn't like definitions. He, as soon as you gave him a definition, he sprung a little outward for it and wanted to see all the connections around it. And that's something I want to talk to you about. I want to skip over cybernetics, unfortunately, because we could do a whole program on that. I'd like to move towards psychology, though, and particularly his involvement with a group of others in developing the double bind theory. What is that theory?
The double bind theory has been taken to mean different things to different groups. So I think it's a good idea to start from the beginning here, which is to say that for Gregory, the double bind theory was really a pattern. It was what he saw as a very useful tool in noticing a pattern in which evolution is an imperative. What the double bind is, just to briefly describe it, it's a lot like what we know as a catch-22, only the stakes are higher and the effect on the person is what is of interest, not the catch-22. Okay, so for example, he used to use, and this is the example he uses in the film, the bread and butterfly from Through the Looking Glass.
The story Gregory used sometimes to explain the double bind was about the gnat in Through the Looking Glass.
And the gnat is a still small voice explaining the insects of Through the Looking Glass land to Alice. We don't have butterflies, we have bread and butterflies. And the bread and butterfly has wings of very thin slices of bread and butter and a head made of a lump of sugar. Alice says, what does it live on? The gnat says, weak tea with cream in it. Alice saw a difficulty.
So she said, what happens if it can't find any? The gnat says, it dies. Alice says, that must happen rather often. The gnat says, it always happens. The double bind in which the bread and butterfly finds himself, namely that if he gets his food, his head dissolves in it. Therefore, his only hope for survival is not to find any food, but then he starves. And this is, you see, a formal double bind of the simplest kind.
So on that level, I think Gregory saw the double bind as a pattern, and one that could be applied to many different kinds of circumstances, not just psychology, but also evolution, creativity, learning, etc., cognition. There's lots of different forms of them, and in any of their forms, they are a call to shift the thinking. There's a need to take the thinking to another level. Upward, downward, deeper, wider, however you want to look at it, the context has to shift for the being in the double bind to find their way out of it.
Well, I'm interested to hear you say that because, you know, surely we're in a double bind right now as a civilization. We need fossil fuels to feed the billions of people we've got on the planet. There's no other way we can feed them. And yet if we continue to use them, we may shift the climate to a point where billions of people may die because agriculture doesn't work anymore, for example, and many other bad things happen. So it seems like we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. But you're suggesting that there could be a way out of the double bind.
Absolutely. I think your assessment is spot on. In order to live from one day to the next, we need to get in our cars and we need to take part in a system that is, in the long term, that may or may not be all that long, inherently deadly. It's inherently eliminating the possibilities of future generations. If we get out of it, we can't feed our kids. And if we stay in it, we're eliminating the possibility for our children's lives. Either way, we're hooped. What do we do? And I think that it's really useful to look at the double bind as a pattern because it does offer, first of all, the familiarity, just to be able to say, oh, this is a pattern. This happens from time to time and not feel quite so engaged in the feedback loop that we're in. I mean, the first step is to see it as a feedback loop. Then, by virtue of doing that, we're able to contextualize it within something larger. I have to say that from here, the next movie that I make, I want to make about improvisation, because that is what I see as being the way we get out of double binds.
I have one word for you then, and it's not one I'm going to explain on the show, but it's bricolage. And that may be part of your film, who knows? This is Radio EcoShock with filmmaker Nora Bateson. It's called An Ecology of Mind, about her famous father, Gregory Bateson, and to a certain degree, about Nora's relationship with him. Nora, I think Stuart Brand was attracted to your father's work in part because of what it said to a generation looking for answers beyond the button-down collars of the 60s, particularly a whole earth solution. Can you talk about Gregory Bateson and the new young crowd in the 1970s?
What a wonderful scene that was. It was a time and an era when there was a great opening and when it was time to break the rules. There was a culture of people who were the change makers. They had amazing conversations, which we're only just now beginning to be able to sort of harvest from. Stuart Brand was certainly part of that group. There were lots of people, Michael Murphy. And before them, in fact, there were the group of the people who were part of the Macy conferences. That era offered such an incredible opportunity because there was a culture of people who were, like you said, breaking the rules. And as they did that, they had each other to bounce ideas off of. Incredible things happened. Also, a lot of nonsense. I grew up in various communities, from the Lindisfarne Foundation to the Zen Center in San Francisco to Esalen Institute. In each of these communities, there were people whose real commitment was to finding a way of living that, from communication to food to intellectual pursuit to philosophy to science, they were looking for a way to integrate the human experience with the natural world and felt that if there was a more holistic approach, that there would be greater satisfaction and greater happiness. And to do that, they took away all the things that would affirm our cultural identity. So, for example, Esalen was out on the rugged coasts of Big Sur. There wasn't a shop around. There was hardly telephone service. People who were there were trying out new ways of living to see if they would work. You know what? They were improvising. They were trying out new things, some of which worked out great, some of which didn't. But that's life, right?
Yeah, and one of the things that kept coming up in this film for me over and over, and perhaps it's the central theme of the film, was Gregory Bateson's insistence that all things are connected, that we have a connection with nature, and that really it's an illusion to think that we could be anything other than part of nature. Can you talk to us about that?
The word interconnection has become a sort of a signature word in the ecological movement. I have to just take a moment to say, I think it's important to actually look deeper than that. When we, by virtue of our own language, when we talk about interconnection, we're still talking about, somewhere in your imagination, I bet you can see, a series of dots connected by lines. And if you were to illustrate the universe as an interconnected thing, you might have various entities and lines that connected them. And where Gregory's work differs there, it's subtle, so bear with me, is that that interconnection is actually interrelatedness. It's actually interdependency. So that those lines, if you could envision them not as static, linear, connected things, but as electric, that they're wiggling and they're dynamic and they're pulsing and they have rhythm and they're evolving. The space in between is evolving. So that's where his idea of what connects us is in itself a learning process. It becomes part of his lens that he had to offer us, which would direct us not so much to making change at the level of policy or economics or commerce, religion, but at a different level. We are participants in a larger system. And as participants, we are in a dynamic system with the creatures and the plants and all the living things, the systems, the wind, the oceans, the systems of our planet. And to recognize the pattern that connects is to recognize that we are in a kind of empathetic relationship, that there are things, there are similarities that we can see when we look at the plankton or we enjoy the wind in our face. There are relationship similarities that we can recognize. Those are at another level than the kind of human constructs such as economics and politics. So the change that Gregory would discuss, or the opening of the possibility of shifting our perspective.
The question of what the ideas are that govern how we think about the world, that those ideas again become linked up with how we live in the world, what sort of damage we do to it, what sort of pollution, exploitation, etc., etc., we engage in.
One thing I noticed in this film is that, you know, Hollywood directors would have told you you must include the love life, the struggles with problems, the dark sides of the man, etc. And yet you went for a pure intellectual biography, kind of the story of his lasting gifts, I would say. Is that going to sell? How are you going to distribute this film, and how can people find out more about it?
I hope it sells. I chose to do that because, honestly, his love life wasn't nearly as interesting as his ideas. I would like to distribute it in any way that its sales can catch the wind. I'm amazed because originally I made this film thinking, oh, it'll probably be a classroom tool. And I've been surprised because there's actually an audience that is interested in it, people who don't know his ideas, who aren't in the midst of studying them. And I think it's actually a good intro to some basic systems theory concepts and a really interesting perspective on the world. I'm going from Vancouver this weekend. I'm going to be down in San Francisco doing a preview for the Bioneers, which is a group of just incredible and wonderful ecologists. And from there, the film is going to Italy. And I have some premieres in Rome and in Milan and in a town outside Venice called Schio. Later on in the beginning, actually, of 2011, I'm going to do a opening at the Museum of Natural History in New York City and just take it from there, see what happens. I've submitted it to film festivals, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of traction it has and whether people like it.
Is there a website for the film?
There is a website for the film. It's www.anecologyofmind.com. And I also have a Facebook site for it, which is An Ecology of Mind, the Gregory Bateson documentary, where you can see a trailer and screenings are posted and there's some photos from the film. But this is the beginnings. And the other thing is that not only did I not wash out the dirty laundry on screen of our family history, but I also took the liberty to use long shots and to allow these people, there's some interesting people in the movie who have a lot to offer, and these ideas need time to understand and to articulate. And so I broke the rules and made space for that time.
Well, what I did was I played it again a couple of times because it's deep. I think it's a deep film and definitely worth watching. We've been talking with Nora Bateson, daughter of a social scientist and anthropologist, too many fields to list them all, really. He lived from 1904 to 1980. Her film explaining Bateson's lasting intellectual gifts is called An Ecology of Mind. It plays at the Vancouver International Film Festival on October 2nd and 3rd. And as we have heard, it's going on to other film festivals. Nora, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. I hope this was useful.
Definitely. I'm Alex Smith.
Our interview with Nora Bateson was recorded on Skype by Vodburner. Check out our video page at ecoshock.org and our YouTube channel. For more links to our guests and information for this program, check out the show blog at ecoshock.info. You'll find my article on rogue psychiatrist Wilhelm Reich was published this month, and there's links to the American Psychological Association report and more. Don't forget, October 10th is the day to express all that climate frustration. Go to 350.org to find your local action. It's now and forever. Get creative, get active. October 10th, all at 350.org.